Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Monday stream. We actually have a Monday stream this time for the first time in a little while.
Yeah, no, I think we had a Monday stream with week.
We
we're
actually have a
back from
Monday
the
stream
holiday.
this time for the first time in a
Oh,
little
you'll
while.
be hearing two of us there
You
because
stuck the I stuck
desktop
the
audio
YouTube thing
through
up.
it. Womp womp.
Oh, that's the only way to know whether we're actually live or not, because the YouTube backend is not the best. Oh dear. We do have a guest with us this week. Don't worry, we were just setting up Discord in the 5 minutes we were off air there. Actually, the problem wasn't out on our end, it turned out. Discord does like reselecting your default audio devices. But welcome to the channel, Horace. I know this is your first time here, so do you wanna say hello and give a people kind of a slight idea about who you are?
Hello. Yeah, good evening to you both. Nice to meet you for the first time, and good evening to everyone in the chat. Maybe it's my fault that you didn't have a show last week. I'm sorry about that. I foolishly ate. If you really want to know, I foolishly ate some smoked salmon that had been in the fridge since before Christmas.
Oh dear, it's like the classic. It's like the salmon mousse sketch in Monty Python.
Oh no.
That's
Well, I wish I'd seen that sketch, and I wish I knew the danger of doing that. But I'm never going to do that again.
you didn't
Obviously.
smoke the salmon enough. You should have
Yeah, you
smoked
should have
it to
smoked
the
it some
point
more.
where it was one of those weird Nordic delicatessens that's all rotten and stuff like that.
Like making it into kippers or something
Ah,
almost.
so strumming.
Well, no. We did have a stream last week. We just had it on a Tuesday. Due to various other scheduling stuff, so we kind of have lots of stream ideas in reserve. Yeah, we have like a list of streams we'd like to a mile long, so we don't tend to struggle for subject matter. So that's no bother, and I'm glad you've got better from your near death experience with smoked salmon.
It wasn't too bad, but it did. Yeah, I would not have been any sort of guest at all last week. So yeah, I'm glad you managed to go ahead anyway.
Well, what do you tend to do online? I know you put videos on Odyssey and you have a Telegram and a Twitter, but like, what is your general kind of online persona shtick, if people don't know?
For anyone who doesn't know, I've made videos in the past, and I'm close to putting out a new one. Should be recording that this week, although I said that a few weeks ago. But on my Odyssey channel, people can see that. But on Telegram, I just whatever seems interesting. But I have to limit my time on social media, as I'm sure you understand. But I
Yes.
just got back on Twitter a few weeks ago, a part of the reinstatement thing,
Oh,
the amnesty.
did Elon personally reach out to you and reinstate life into you or something like
I mean, he didn't sign the email or anything.
that?
It was actually a disappointingly bland email, actually. But I was pleased to receive it. I have been messaging Elon. He's busy, you know. I mean, he doesn't reply to every one of my tweets, but I understand. But he's doing good work. He's doing good work. So, in all seriousness, I'm actually really positive about Elon taking over Twitter. I think it's been a great thing so far. And but yeah, on there, I mean, like my I haven't. Since I got back on, I haven't like really thought of a new approach yet. I used to have a thing of deliberately trying to blend all sorts of people, like, you know, we're sort of ethno-nationalists, like, but trying to blend with civic nationalists, blend with like counter-jihad people, blend with like centre-right, frustrated Tories especially. I was always looking out for people who are absolutely sick to death and have given up on the Tories because I mean, not that there's anything to replace them with yet. I mean, unless you count reform. But yeah, I'm trying to convince people that's a good thing to do, just to give up on the Tories, even if you don't have anyone to vote for. And hopefully, by the next election, there will be somebody to vote for. I was always trying to, like demoralise and undermine the Tory Party
It's
online.
a worthwhile pursuit. I don't know,
Absolutely.
the Elon amnesty has been strangely scattershot but also strangely focused in some places.
Yeah, I'm still not entirely sure. I think I've sort of mentioned elsewhere that to me it kind of seems like he's bringing back a spectrum of people, if you'll pardon the pun, so that in future a new kind of line could be drawn of, oh well, everyone up to Sargon or Uptoon, including Sargon, just as one example of someone who may be sitting in the middle of that spectrum of people that have been reintroduced.
I just think it seems odd and random. There's a lot of people I know who have had relatively large Twitter accounts who've done, you know, were quite boilerplate really, and they've not been it seems I don't know. It's either there's a deliberate plan of who to bring back and who to bring not back, or there is no plan and it's complete chaos. But
Sargon's tweet game has come along in the years that he was banned. He's doing some good stuff. Like, he's become a bit more hardcore himself over the last, you know, since Gamergate, which is good. But yeah, I mean, I suspected that. Well, yeah, that was my first thought. That yeah, like it's to incorporate a section of the center right in order to keep out the right. You know, I assumed that was the game. I assumed Elon was exactly the sort of person who would do that. But why has he got me back on? Why has he got Mark Collett joined the other day? Why has he got JF Gariepi? Tommy Robinson was allowed back on the other day. So these are all like... Tommy Robinson, I know that obviously like I consider the guy a complete fake and a scammer, but he is someone who has had the vilification of, you know, most of the political most politicians and media and so on. Like, he's really, really vilified. I mean, wrongly. I mean, you know, he's actually really weak in his stance. But he's back on. And yeah, Mark Collett, you know, roundly denounced as a neo-Nazi by the whole media. He's back on, you know. Andrew Anglin is apparently back on.
Mm-hmm. See, this is, it's all just a really big workaround so that I can suggest that because I'm not allowed back on Twitter, I'm more dangerous than most of these people.
you're not back on yet?
No, I don't think my account's coming back at any point soon because the viral tweet that's pinned underneath my account when it got deleted was about how I got visited by the police for my activity on Twitter. So,
yeah, that... none of my account, many accounts have been reinstated.
Elon is not going to bring back all of the scrumps.
No. It's not going to be like the end game meme.
And see, I'm glad he's not going to bring all the scrumps back because I don't have to deal with you engaging in some sort of bizarre, like, para-social media schizophrenia as you have, like, 19 different scrump gimmick accounts which you try and keep thematically consistent.
I'll go through some normal YouTube-y stuff. We are still somehow monetized on YouTube. Don't know how that keeps happening, but we do. Mm-hmm. We do have a backup on Odyssey as well. If people want to follow us there, and if you don't, you know, if you're sick to death of YouTube, we do all our stuff gets auto reuploaded to Odyssey, so we do have that as a backup as well. But you can send super chats, super stickers, all the weird stuff that YouTube lets you send. But the best way to do it is through Streamlabs. Because they take less of a cut. We do try and answer the chat anyway. We're not, you know, we don't just answer paid super chats and things, but that is the best way to guarantee that your question will be seen and to support us. Apart from that, I know it's kind of gay YouTube-y stuff, but interaction helps.
Yes.
You know, ye olde like and comment, but it does definitely help. And as Rillon... God, I couldn't read that then. Has done there. We do have memberships as well, which is the recurring way.
Thank you for becoming a new member.
Yes, which is the recurring way you can.
I think maybe to steer the conversation otherwise. Yes. It's something that we've talked to Woz about a couple of times. It's something I think an interest in the area where different subsections of the right have been pushed into has meant that there's a lot going on at the moment still. There's a lot of people who hadn't really talked to each other before and sort of groups bumping into each other that would have otherwise probably been enemies previously. I mean, I consider myself one of these people who's a sort of reformed libertarian who would have probably considered...
A lot better.
Yes. Oh, yeah, exactly. I would have considered myself maybe previously at odds with people who are more open to... You know, national socialism, third positionism, that kind of stuff. But in a similar vein, those people who would be of that group have been forced out of their own space by COVID, by technocracy stuff, and by sort of just generally becoming dissuaded and disaffected with how modern politics works in general. And in doing that, seeing the root problems of their own sort of ideologies behind that, as I did with libertarianism. And watching markets and economics and this, that, the next thing become an excuse for unfettered immigration. So it's pushed us all into a weird space where we're all kind of trying to work out what everyone's actually into and what's going on.
Oh, yeah. I don't know, Horace. Have you found that kind of the last couple, especially since like the lockdowns and stuff, has united, kind of pushed people into a shared dissident space where before they were quite fragmented?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely reformed things, realigned things, isn't it? And I think it still is realigning things. My experience may be slightly the opposite of yours, Evelyn, in that, I was libertarian since I sort of first really started reading about that in mid-2000s until, sort of more like the mid-2010s when I just found that, like, I was part of some libertarian groups on Facebook and other social media, and I found that libertarians, you know, like, there's some great ones, but the ones who make all the noise are ones who are just completely pointless people, just like absolutely not thinking about achieving anything, right? All it seems to consist in for them is just look at the news and then just do libertarian takes on it, which always just consists of defending business against government, against some potential government move, and never acknowledging that business and government are just almost constantly in alliance against the people. Like, that's how it works. It's not a war like Ayn Rand would make you believe. Like there's a constant defense of business to be made. It's bullshit. No, like, big business loves government. And like feeds into it and writes regulations and so on and so on. But when it came to the lockdowns a couple of years ago, seeing the whole world accede to that, go along with it. And also, especially in our sphere, some people were actually positively enthusiastic about it because it was anti-liberal. That made me swing back somewhat, and I've been a bit more reassertive about libertarianism since then. But suffice to say, I was not a supporter of the lockdowns.
Oh, no.
And certainly not like vaccine pressure or anything like that. I'm very pro Rothbard and Hopper myself. I still really value them.
Oh yeah, I'm quite. There's a lot of people I think have kind of they do too much of the changing ideology every week, where they kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, I still think, especially here in Britain, we do have a lot of kind of the heirs of the actual liberal theory, as the libertarians were. And actually, I ended up writing an essay about how Hopper and Rothbard are kind of the real heirs to the kind of the English liberal tradition, rather than having the kind of gay socialist liberalism.
Adam Smith Institute, neoliberal folk, and
utilitarian mills and all that. Yeah.
Like ASI are enemies outright. What's the other one as well? There's the Adam Smith Institute. There's another major one, like the. They both just pretty much work with the Tory party anyway. They're enemies. They're outright enemies. God, they're strongly pro-immigration.
There's some of the ones that are associated with, like, the London School of Economics. Because I remember I used to follow that Christian Nemitz guy on Twitter.
Yeah.
He used to be one of the libertarian big brains. And I remember at some point having an interaction with him at some point, and he did pull the whole, like, well, you want to put culture before economics? Say it ain't so.
Like, what does it say in Rothbard that you shouldn't do that? Well, who's the other one? Sam Bowman. Did you ever encounter him? Awful person.
I think I remember that name from somewhere, but I may have blanked it out of my mind.
I think he's like now head of one of those, or research head, or like pretty senior anyway. What's the other one called? There's the Adam Smith Institute, and there's another one.
There's a lot of them. There's one that comes to mind that works with both Labour and the Tories, but most of the Tories these days, called the Social Market Foundation. And they recently put out a piece saying that immigration at 1 million a year could become normal for the UK. There's all kinds of these like NGO think tanks, and they're all staffed by basically the same people. And I don't know, that I've always found that's some of the best ammunition for busting people out, like, who are just about clinging on by their fingernails to the Tory bubble, especially slightly older people who just haven't heard of a lot of this stuff. It's funny, sometimes on our videos or sometimes on Twitter, you'll get people encountering who obviously haven't encountered that kind of stuff before. And they're like, oh no, things might be worse than I thought. And I sometimes feel sorry, especially for the more boomer contingent. who ends up having their kind of Tory home counties bubble burst by hitting reality.
They've not considered the fact that all these people who they've looked up to as like stalwarts of what was left like 70s and 80s conservatism, of what little that really was in terms of conservative.
Yeah, to
even that was asinine and was actually really just a mask for another technical development political theory.
It's all based on, like, I mean, so many of these sort of pro-Tory myths are based on the idea that at least Thatcher's government was, I don't know what they would say, good, or at least it was economically good. But like, I see Thatcher's, I've come to see it this way, that Thatcher's government was the time, and obviously that's a full 11 years, a long time, but like that was the time when people were convinced to care only about economics. That's really the only sense in which Thatcher was, and I put it very vaguely, like right wing. Like on culture, they completely gave ground, like gave the whole field to the left. I wrote to like Sean Gabb. Do you know Sean Gabb? He was like a British libertarian.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. He wrote a book called Cultural Revolution, Culture War. It was a weird title, but it's a very, very good book. And in that, he alludes to the, I think it was in that, maybe it was in one of his other essays actually, but that's a very good book. But he says that, yeah, like Thatcher, like all these libertarians, so-called, of the 80s did was they just, yeah, like they deregulated a few parts of the market. They obviously denationalized certain things. But in terms of the left taking over the institutions, they pretty much approved of it. I think in the minds of a lot of so-called libertarian Tories, their thinking is we let the left have everything as long as we win on economics. I think they actually want the left to control everything else. They see it as a pain in the ass.
It's like a worked example of Sullivan's Law. The denationalisation of industry and the reorientation around business was all framed as sort of ideologically neutral and purely technical. So they set up all these institutes for collecting data on workers or collecting data on the NHS or this, that or the next thing. And then the interpretation of that data was completely left open to be done by completely like ardent leftist ideologues under the guise that they were mutually imposing scientific theory.
You know what's depressing? The place that has the best definition of O'Sullivan's Law is actually Urban Dictionary. The rest of it is like weird wankery. But those of you don't know who O'Sullivan's Law is, it says that any organization or enterprise that is not explicitly or expressly right-wing will become left-wing over time, which is something that we see happen continuously.
Mm. And then everyone tries and says it's Robert Conquest's second law, which is not true.
It's not true.
John O'Sullivan, who's a Brit, wrote it about a year beforehand.
He did do, yes. But that is... I think there was this idea that as long as you set up the neutral ground, you made everything neutral, as long as government got out of the way, that the culture would reset itself, and that, you know, very marketplace of ideas thinking, whether deliberately naive or not. And it completely failed. They completely stepped away from actively competing in the cultural space, and they allowed themselves to be routed.
Worst of all, constantly giving their followers then and ever since the impression that they did fight the left and they did defeat the left. So all you did was you just rolled back part of the post-war consensus on the economic front. That's all they did. And that's in 11 years, and most of that time they had huge majorities in Parliament as well. One of the worst things I've ever seen... there's this documentary from the 2000s called Tory, 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 and Neil Hamilton's in it. He's a very... have you seen it?
No,
just the title alone's funny.
The name.
It's a play on that film, Tora, 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 I think. It's like a war film set in Japan, something like that. Anyway, it's a play on that. The documentary is actually quite good, but it's... There's a bit with Neil Hamilton, who was like an arch Thatcherite in the 80s, and he says so blithely and glibly that, like, of course, Tony Blair's, 4 miles to the left of where we were now. Sorry, what was it? My brain's not functioning. He implies that that the victory was so total that Tony Blair couldn't roll it back. That, like, Tony, yeah, he says Tony Blair's even further to the right of where we were in the 80s. It's like, no, Neil, you cretin. Like, what, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like,
yeah, no, I like, think
the,
you could...
the country, this is not a right wing, this is, we're not in a right wing situation. Anyway, sorry.
No, I was going to say, you can look at it in a similar way that the fall of the intellectual right, and there's a lot of people that probably, they'll probably get at me for this, but if you go back and you read people like Carlyle or Yawkey to some extent, definitely Eric Ritter von Kuhnelt Leyden, I know that Hopper has a bit of this view as well, whereby the idea of race and the nation and sort of local community all kind of becomes deracinated and replaced with the materialist idea of the nation, just very base level nationalism.
Yeah, it's we always talk about the Thatcher government in that what they did was they made the dystopia more efficient. Well, they didn't row it back.
Well, not necessarily. What I was going to say is the fact that it's touted that, you know, the intellectual mistake of the right and the turn from the 19th to 20th century was adopting the ideology of nationalism.
Yeah,
and you could argue really that the intellectual mistake of the right and the 21st century is adopting the ideological stance of the free market as some sort of stalwart of rightist ideology, which it actually has never been.
In like the Bioshock, Andrew Ryan, fag packet objectivist sense, yeah.
Oh, have you seen American Krogan did very interesting work on Bioshock? I mean, yeah, the ideology behind it. I recommend people watch that. Slightly a side point here, but just a little nod to that. In terms of depending on what people mean by free market, I mean, in the hands of the Tories, it means something quite different from what a real libertarian would mean by it, I think. I mean, well, I'm for the free market in the sense that I'm not in favour of state control of the economy. You know?
Well, see,
so by default, but I'm not in the favour of the free market in the sense of let's force the market on the whole world or on the whole country.
Yeah.
But see, regardless of whatever else happens, it's crazy.
I'm also very much of the opinion, though, that trying to call it a free market or mixed economy or whatever variation of socialism or democratic socialism you would like to call it is sort of a waste of time, because as soon as you engage in a level of mass organisation, that it has to be first and foremost technical before it's any kind of, you know, ideological adherence or consistency to some sort of idea or principle of freedom or ethic of fairness. First and foremost, it must just be a machine that works. You know, it must be neither capitalist or socialist, but first productive.
I think there's a lot of stuff that people have taken as ideological, which really, like, it doesn't really matter what the ideology behind it is, because as we've seen over the past couple of, well, over the past couple of years especially, there's very much a life behind how power works, especially now internationalist power, and talking about things in an old worldy right v left kind of markets versus socialism dynamic has fallen apart in many ways. It's as many, I think, have realized, and as you've probably seen, it's become like a fight for political survival for people who don't believe in actually living in the pod, like the eco pod. And there's really just kind of a divide between people who aren't with the program and people who are with the program, and you even on the left you have that divide as well. We've talked about articles from people like the Grey Zone and certain disaffected left aspects, but it really just does seem like there's those who realize what's going on, and there's those who don't and are kind of still going along with it. It's very interesting to see that dynamic shape really kind of outside of the limits of ideology.
Well, you think of it as well. The capitalist versus socialist debate of a century or a century and a half prior was a debate on specific elements of policy, because the worldview, for the most part, would have actually been not too dissimilar. They would have both been religious. They would have both looked to the church as some kind of institution worth venerating. They would have, in some level, still actually believed in the principle of hierarchy as a sort of metaphysics. It was just about the nature of how the economy was organized, not the complete rewriting of society under either the complete total domineering ethic of socialism or of capitalism.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, what, so essentially, are you guys saying that a whole different alignment is appropriate of, you know, where traditional understanding of left and right, and certainly if those, if left and right are based primarily around socialism and capitalism, is like long, long out of date.
Yes.
Out of date. Yeah, yeah. I mean, just, I mean, if we're in a situation where the question of whether this people gets to have its own society without it being deliberately destroyed by those above, if that's not a part of the debate, then the debate is useless. Well, the debate is working for the destroyers, really. It's working for the rulers.
Well, what I put in the thumbnail was a big bus full of fresh off the boat people being taken to their brand new hotel, and I think that's become one of the biggest fault lines in British politics is whether or not you can actually speak out about we talked about the Social Market Foundation, them trying to normalize the idea of a million immigrants, and the Social Market Foundation, by the way, was John Major's favorite think tank. Yeah. To put it in context. This is John Major's favorite think tank talking about a million immigrants a year. What do you think is the most pressing issue, one, from your point of view, facing Britain, but two, that you see? I know you talked about having disaffected Tories talking to you and all that. Like, what is both the big issue that you see and the big issue that you think other people are latching onto in terms of what's going wrong with Britain? Because there is a widespread feeling about something is definitely wrong, but a lot of people don't seem to be able to express it very well.
I think, like, the use of the term globalism is correct. I mentioned that I've got a new video that I'll be putting out soon. Actually, well, probably a series of videos. It's looking at the history of Britain joining the EU, you know, being in it and then leaving it up until now. So it's from the end of the Second World War up until now. And what I found in that, I mean, the guy who mostly designed the European Union was Jean Monnet, who some people would have heard of. Jean Monnet, I didn't realise until I started researching this, was friends with all the Rockefeller people in America. did you guys know this?
I did know this.
This sounds a bit like one of these Anthony C. Sutton numbers.
I was aware of that, yes. A lot of American history, because we've done a huge amount of stuff on early 20th century kind of American history and the democratization of America, really, and how it was led by partially two political camps that were a rivalry between the J.P. Morgan camp and the Rockefeller camp.
It's more Rockefeller Rothschild, but Morgan is then, because they were touted as like it's the high street Wall Street split, and you had a similar thing here in Britain where you had elements of industry that were quite adamant on being more autarkic and self-sufficient, and the other end of that was your more sort of internationalist bankery financial class that wanted to move more into the, you know, Thatcherite model of the service economy, where we just provide loads of financial services for people in the developing world, and that's an economy somehow can be built upon that.
And I was aware of John Monnet. I was aware of his links to the Rockefellers, among other people. But yeah, it's amazing when you look at who these EU technocrats are, who their allies are. It's very clear that they come from a certain class.
It's really amazing. It presents itself as, yeah, like something for the unification of Europe. It's about the unified control of Europe by super elites who have a totally global perspective. There's nothing about the European Union that's supposed to be a benefit to the people, and the people are held in more or less open contempt. Like, it was designed from the start to strictly exclude them from all decision-making. It was absolutely deliberate and intentional on Monet's part and everyone who he went along with. So my answer to the original question was, I think this struggle of ordinary people versus globalists is probably the most like prevalent theme, albeit most, well, I don't know how many, but most ordinary people are still only, well, not aware of it or barely aware of it. However, some room for optimism in that I think 2020, the lockdown agenda, the lockdown and vaccine agenda, really has shocked a lot of people who never really took an interest in, you know, matters of malevolent rulers before, you know, ill-intentioned rulers, and has converted a lot of people to seeing it that way, which is good. And, you know, they're not just seeing it in terms of lockdowns and vaccines. They're thinking about immigration, and they're thinking about accountability, and, you know, like, you know, popular sovereignty as well, which I think is a good thing. So I think things are polarizing along lots of different lines, but it's forming into roughly two sides. I've had that feeling for a few years.
I think we're still very much in a process of everything shaking itself out. I still wonder at how long it's going to be before the wider sort of ethno-nationalist community really comes to grips with what effect the vaccine has had on long-term genetics. I mean, I know it's something, was it Philosopher Cat brought up in Millennial the year previous to us being on? And she basically suggested this kind of notion of, well, what if we have to consider the fact that people who are vaccinated aren't white in the way that we thought of them before? And lots of people there was no thinking about it for more than a second. It was just straight away, no, you can't say that. That's evil. That's wrong. You're subversive. We should just talk about the Jews instead and ignore the fact that there is a glaring, obvious, you know, contradiction, or at least hurdle in the whole idea of restoring some sort of healthy white demographic. Is, well, what if, you know, 60-70% of the population has taken something that either makes them, one, infertile, or two, genetically different from people who aren't vaccinated anymore?
Or just unhealthy and unable to undertake certain kinds of work. And there's all things. A lot of it is that we just, it's an unknown. It's, I don't know, it's quite a big one. What are your thoughts on that, Horace?
Well, so she was, I remember the controversy around her on Woes 20, on Millennial 2021, right? That's what you were referring
yes,
to.
Yes, it is.
I remember that. But I didn't actually see the whole conversation. I remember being a bit annoyed because I thought she was just kind of blackpilling. Maybe I misunderstood, but because I'm very much against anyone who does that. But I hadn't even occurred to me that she's saying that, like, in. Well, if I understand correctly, what she's saying, that, like, we might have to sort of leave a large part of our race behind.
Oh, no, and I'm maybe sort of paraphrasing and truncating what she suggests a little bit, but at least not clarify, you know, saying that for definite you now have to look at people who are vaccinated as some lesser race of people that you can't mingle with or anything. Oh. But at least trying to think through, you know, what are the ramifications of whatever genetic damage the vaccine might do on the longer terms. I mean, if you are someone who wants to procreate, you want healthy children. What if someone who is a vaccinated partner can't give you healthy children anymore?
Right. That is something that had not occurred to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's not one of those things. I fully understand what you mean by saying you're not a fan of people who are black pillars. Neither are we. I hate this whole notion of, like, doom scrolling, like looking at you know, drag queen story hour stuff or demographic statistics all day on social media with no practical solutions in front of you is a complete waste of your time, and you're going to destroy your own mental health doing so.
Or reading Peter Hitchens,
But on some level, you also, you know, we're going to have to think about these things. I mean, what's...
Yeah, and of course, being against the black pill doesn't mean ignoring reality. I mean, she may be right. She may, that may really have happened. Yeah. Okay, well, it hadn't occurred to me. My assumption is that the vaccine isn't as bad as that. My assumption is that, yeah, it's certainly very... Well, it's killing some people, I'm sure. excuse me. I hope you can say that on YouTube.
We've said worse on YouTube.
Yeah, we haven't.
We're just kind of fly beneath the radar. And like I said, we have backups, so we thought we might as well use YouTube to let us be here. So we don't really kind of pull our punches or censor what we say at all.
Well, the sort of salami approach that you said Elon Musk might be doing, maybe YouTube see you as useful against the real right, you know.
I just, it's all come full circle.
I think the problem is that we're just too small to be noticed. We've not caught the eye of Sauron yet, I think is most of it. Yeah, Susan is angry. I also think that making long form content with slightly esoteric subject matter sometimes saves you.
Oh, but, entirely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I assume that the vaccine, well, yeah, it appears that the vaccine damage is really bad. I mean, I really hope it's not what you alluded to there. But I think that one angle, I don't know if this really relates to what you were saying, but like the one angle I find really interesting is there's a guy called Tom Luongo. Do you know, have you heard of him?
I think I've heard the name floating about.
He's on with Pete Quiñones.
Ah, yeah.
Oh, yes, I have. I must have seen him then.
Yeah.
He talks quite fast and he talks over people. And he's a little bit annoying, but he's smart and he's interesting. And he suggests that what we're one, you know, among the many things happening in the world, one major thing is that in terms of like elite power factions and globalists, there are several of those. And we have been living under, all of Europe has been living under the Davos faction. Which seems true. All our leaders seem to be very, very friendly to Schwab and Davos and so on. I think that's right. And you know, implementing his kind of ideas, what they're doing amounts roughly to what he's called for in the Great Reset and so on and so on. However, he says the American sort of traditional banking cartel, I would say, you know, JP Morgan, Rockefellers and so on and so on, they are another faction, and Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve, who is a very important civil servant, or whatever you call him, he's in their faction, and his conduct of Fed policy is intentionally, we're in the middle of this now, wiping out Europe, basically bringing down European economies, because there's, the way he explained it all made sense, I can't fully make sense of it, but it's kind of just good policy, and also because these are rival factions and they have completely had enough of Davos. Davos is kind of crazy. I don't know where the war in Ukraine fits in with all this, though, because, I mean, that is terrible economically, obviously, the sanctions, I mean. But he says, yeah, we're like, what we're going to see over the next few years, I think, is Europe being wrecked. I mean, it's bad enough already, but it's going to be wrecked economically. Because the Fed is going to keep putting up interest rates much higher than everyone expects. And Europe is not going to be able to cope. Like, capital will flow out of Europe and into America, where obviously, you know, if nothing else, they can earn a reasonable return just by owning treasury bills and stuff. It's not really reasonable when inflation is as high as it is, but, you know, just compared to anything else. And we may see, you know, like if we assume that the lockdown and vaccine agenda was largely driven by Davos, I mean, that can't be the whole story, but we might be seeing that all fall apart. So we might see a lot of genuine honesty coming out about the vaccines now that, I mean, there seems to be creeping into the mainstream news. And we might see, and we already have seen in some cases, but we might see more and more European governments falling, not being replaced by the exact same people. Although when Keir Starmer, if and when Keir Starmer comes prime minister, he is a kind of a Rockefeller man because he's in the Trilateral Commission. I mean, it's not, you know, that doesn't describe the whole man, but I mean, it's
he's the he's very much the ultimate global stooge candidate, much like Sunak. We have reached a stage in Britain where we have two stooges. But to go back to your point about America and the European faction and Davos and. I always think of it the other way around. I think that Davos is the mouthpiece of whatever faction, you know, runs the EU and the power behind that, because a lot of the people in Davos are very much front of house people. A lot of the real power people aren't front and center, but it's kind of by the by. But the big thing is that America is the global hegemon. What they say goes, and Europe has always suffered. They suffered in the First World War, they suffered in the Second World War, they suffered during the Cold War. They suffered during the kind of agreements after the Cold War. Europe always gets kind of, it's the battered wife of America. And it doesn't really matter what European nations want as long as they're on the defense teat, really, of America. It's kind of, America can really do what it was. There's a, I don't know if you've read it, there's a Substack called Fisted by Foucault, which is pretty good. And they did a piece that was just entitled Turbo America. which is this idea, like you talked about the traditional banking class there and the power faction of essentially like the expansionist forever war neocons being at the center of that. And there is this very bullish idea in America that they refer to as Turbo America, that they can take on, you know, whatever genuine opposition still exists in China, even though China and America are quite well integrated. They can take on Russia. They can smash down the EU as a rival power center. And they can do it basically all at once because they bought, I think, a lot of the American faction, as we might want to call it, even though it's kind of imperfect, has bought into the idea of the kind of the American invincibility. And we're reaching the point where a lot of their elites are like third generation post-war elites.
Mm.
And they genuinely do not understand perhaps some of the fragility of their situation. And they're really kind of going for the gold of, you know, slap down the European Union as a second castle kind of thing. And really get the whole like actual American-led global government thing going. And that kind of feels like what a lot of the American policy is tending towards. It's one of the better explanations I've seen of it on Turbo America, Fist of Life, or Co. But it's not perfect. And the problem is we work with limited information. We don't really know what the end game is. It very much, the Ukraine stuff is relatively obvious in that, one, it's about diminishing Russia's defense capacity in an Afghanistan kind of sense, of getting them into a quagmire of war. But two, it really did become about America reasserting its complete economic dominance of Europe and Europe's complete economic reliance on America in like a post-World War II sense. It's about, you know, it's really about, I think Europe has got a bit big for its boots from where I'm sitting, you know, from on the power stage, and America's really just reminding them who the hegemon is, I think.
Well, they were like in the 90s, right? So even though I myself said, you know, not long ago that like the Monet and the founding of the EU is definitely at the behest of the American sort of especially the foreign policy establishment, which was totally controlled by the Rockefellers. Despite that, in the 90s and perhaps into the 2000s, there were various EU people who really thought that they could become a counterforce to America. They clearly did. They started trying to cooperate with China when it came to space and arms, like buying arms, and I think from China, which was surprising. Britain never went along with this. Britain was like wholly, you know, into this idea of the special relationship and so on. But others, like especially France always tries to imagine itself as like against America, which is just bollocks, really.
A similar thing happened in the 60s and the 70s. America decides, or shall I say, financiers in America decide that they're going to completely detach the global economy from gold just prior to Nixon closing the gold window. And several EU nations at the time take advantage of the American, like, quote-unquote open market operations. It was them selling off gold at an unbelievably undervalued price in hopes to completely deflate the whole gold market. But what happened instead was that no matter how much they sold, gold constantly went up. I think they were aiming for something like $35 an ounce. And across this whole several-year period, they ended up with something like $42 an ounce or something like that at the end of it. And they gave up with a program. But in the meantime, there was days where there would be thousands of physical tons of gold would be leaving America to land on European shores and Swiss. Anthony Sutton goes on to talk about the gnomes of Geneva, as he calls them, who are these people that are supposedly these evil old-worldy bankers that the Fed would like us to not be in cahoots with because they're into gold and all sorts of oldie-worldie magic. But that notion, as you're saying there, that there was at one point a class of European elites who did want to stick it to America and were not happy with the hegemony exercised by the American sort of imperial program over Europe after World War II. And you can see that also, you were talking about the setting up of the EU right at the end of World War II. Very much a notion in there in De Jouvenel's The Problems of Socialist England, which is a bit of a rare book to get a hold of, but if you can, it's a great read. some of it's kind of dry and analytical, but at one point he does a very good explanation of how the whole like fake dollar economy was set up. That Britain and the British Empire ran around the world with bags full of gold and silver for 100 years and taught people to trade with these sort of commodities and think of them as money, and that they could then go and trade amongst themselves with these bits of gold and silver. And the inverse of that was that America showed up with dollar debt and gave everyone debt instead.
Yeah.
The gold and silver for other rare goods and spices and productive capacity. And that right in that kind of period of 1948, there's just unbelievable amounts of productivity and values flowing out of Britain day in, day out, try and keep up with the debts that they've put themselves under to America. I'm trying to remember the name of the specific program that it was at the moment.
Oh, you mean Lend-Lease?
Yes, Lend-Lease. That's exactly the one.
Oh, right. Lend-Lease was basically how America ensured that they took over the world from the British Empire. That's how I, to summarize it in one sentence, that was their way of doing it.
That's exactly the way De Juvenel explains it just before. I think he wrote that book before On Power, so he wouldn't have looked at it as the castle angle, but it must have got him thinking about it.
Yes, I imagine so.
I think America planned that before the war as well. Roosevelt is like a figure whose deviousness is understated by most historians. I think Roosevelt really had a plan, and it largely consisted of diminishing Britain. I think France he probably expected was going to fall apart anyway, but to take apart the British Empire and to supplant Britain as the number one power in the world, all in league with Stalin. He positively liked the Soviet Union as well. Anyway, sorry, that's beside the point. But I like to emphasise the iniquity of Roosevelt. I absolutely hate him.
It's interesting. We mentioned Anthony C. Sutton's The War on Gold. There's another book by Anthony C. Sutton called Wall Street and FDR, which is really worth a read.
I've read the Wall Street trilogy.
Yes, they're all great. The Wall Street trilogy is just like a series of receipts. It's so well sourced, you can't really argue with any of it, which is great. Big fan of those. It's kind of a shame that Anthony C. Sutton went a bit. I don't know. He bought into a few things in later life.
Some weird kicks. Yeah. Point energy stuff.
Yeah, cold fusion stuff like that. But his stuff in his kind of good era is excellent. I'm glad to have read that.
Oh, right. Yeah. Did he avoid falling into the trap of thinking that America was like the British Empire recreated, though? Quite a few theorists argue that Britain controls America, like now, like the British establishment.
No, he's very well aware that it goes the other way around.
Yeah, extremely aware.
Right, good.
He almost, in a certain sense, in some of his stuff, it actually surprised me to think of it that no one's ever explicitly said it, but you could not do the Lend-Lease in World War II without the Federal Reserve that was set up in 1913 before World War I.
Yeah.
You know, you would need that system of, or at least that institution, the system of money management that came with it to make the whole Lend-Lease program 20, 30 years actually work.
Yeah. And I think you would also need, if not the First World War, at least the Great Depression, to convince a lot of American politicians to agree to these things, because it really took a lot to convert them from what is called isolationism.
Yeah.
They did not want to help Britain. It was only when they were convinced that they, quote, had to, that they agreed to all these things. It's remarkable that, obviously, after the First World War, a lot of American politicians rejected the Versailles settlement, rejected the League of Nations because they infringed, they overwrote American sovereignty. But in the later days of the Second World War, the Senate voted almost unanimously for the United Nations organization. What a turnaround. And that was achieved to get that. I mean, that's really what the New Deal, people always, sort of speak of the New Deal as this economic package to save everyone from the Depression. The New Deal was a vision of reorganizing the whole world, including America. And these were major parts of it. Like defeating what they call isolationism was perhaps the key. And destroying Germany, destroying Hitler's Germany.
There's a, gr- that, There's some great stuff if you look at Woodrow Wilson compared to FDR that we talked about during the democratization series, because Woodrow Wilson comes back from Europe. He's, you know, he's a very big supporter of, you know, globalism, really. And he can't quite get the Americans yet on side. He basically dies trying in 1920. He goes on this big railway tour and he essentially destroys his legacy doing that. He becomes an incredibly unpopular figure almost overnight. By telling America they need to be the World Bank, the World Police, and kind of the World Parliament. His message is not very well received, but you're right. I guess in 1945, only 25 years later, and it's unanimous. It's unanimous that America should, you know, should take on this role as the global hegemon and should be the world policeman and should be,
make,
you know,
the world safe for democracy.
Make the world safe for democracy. And the way I always try to put it to people is that we always get told that liberal democracy and all of these wonderful things that we have are prevent war. But you can only really see the First and Second World Wars as like massive amounts of human sacrifice on the altar of making that being able to happen. You couldn't have the League of Nations turning into the United Nations. You couldn't have it unitedly voted in by the Senate without killing millions of people. And once you kind of see killing millions of people as part of that plan, you can't help but see, you know, the kind of post-war elite that we have now as inheriting a great amount of evil. I think that's kind of the there's some people who've been red-pilled in quotes, though I don't like that term, who've come into a more of a distant space just through reading history, I think, as well.
I'm definitely one of those. I definitely got into this space in particular by reading about history. I developed the conclusion, I can't remember exactly when, but within the last, in the last 10 years, that I just picked up on the fact that everything right-wing or like protective of tradition or anything like that is called fascist. And I was like, right, so this goes back to the Second World War. That's when the word fascist was established as the worst thing you can be. So let's study the Second World War. And indeed I did so and found that it's nothing like what we were told. You know, it's not, you know, it was not started for these moral reasons. It was, if anyway, I won't go too much into detail about that, but it was, you know, it was, it's not this just war that we're talking, you know, the one good war. Americans actually called it the good war. It's just horrifying.
There's a great bit in Schmidt where he basically describes kind of how the Second World War would become to seen. Is it that the Second World War is almost like his idea of like the war of the pacifists? His idea was that politics is such that it must drive people to conflict. Therefore, if you believe in pacifism righteously enough, that it will cause you to wage a war against war, which is, I think, a great concept. That's really how the Second World War was put forward. The democracies were put forward as pacifists and being, you know, forced into all this killing. And it is kind of like Schmidt's War of the Pacifists. It's kind of amazing when you see that framing and how it became.
There was a note I put something earlier on that was exactly.
Okay.
But no,
just going to say it's like an idiot form of pacifism.
Yes.
It requires ignorance.
Yeah, it's deliberately like a naive framing, but it is very ridiculous how the Second World War is put forward and how we still live in its propaganda. But to kind of to move on from the more internationalist and history side of stuff, I was wondering, because we try and be relatively positive on these streams. We try, like you said, we don't try to black pill people, even though some people seem to think that describing reality is black pilling, like we said earlier. But what do you think then is something in Britain especially, because we try and keep quite local with some of our politics? What is something you think in Britain that could be done by people now? Like, what do you see as some of the solutions to the, no, I called the stream New Britain, Old Problems. We still have kind of the same problems, really, that we did immediately post-war in the 1960s. But what do you see as kind of the ways out and the things that people can do to alleviate some of the issues right now?
For me, this is like one of the hardest questions. I'm not that practical. I sort of, I'll try and think of something. I mean, like, I would say technological solutions, but I'm not very good at, I can't make tech myself. But like, if it can be, if there's a way, if there's some sort of, if somebody could build some sort of technology that can show and constantly remind people in a way that they can't ignore that their politicians are not even the shit sort of crap thing that they think they are. There's a lot of people out there who say, I don't mind legal immigration, but we've got to stop the illegals. If there's something that can show people that the Tories don't even believe in that, that can help. Some sort of like political technology in that sense could help. But I mean, just speaking very broadly, I think like the building of a parallel economy, that applies everywhere. I mean, it's harder in Britain than in America because there's less physical space, easier to hunt down and be taken by the state, basically. Whereas in America, it is genuinely viable to build sort of anyway, but like to build separate ways of life out in America because there's so much space. But what could be done in Britain? What can be done in Britain? I really don't know.
Well,
It's a, we're in a terrible state, a dire state. But you said white pills. You said white pills.
oh no, it's I th well, you hint a degree of parallelism in Britain, I think, is possible. It's not something you just need space for. You just kind of need a community and an agreement to have parallelism. It's actually something the Muslims managed to do relatively successfully. Yes, they were allowed and aided in doing it by the British state, really. But having some sense of parallelism, having parallel institutions, having kind of parallel support structures for people, kind of building our own stuff from the ground up, because we are in a ground up situation, I think, is one of the main things I try to stress to people. So I wouldn't say that parallelism is impossible in the UK. It's maybe slightly, it is slightly harder than it is in the US. But it is definitely something people can look at into kind of establishing exchanges between each other, establishing, proper links with each other in real life. And kind of becoming a community and then having an economy within that community. And it's a lot of people think it's a bit too basic, but we, like I said, we are starting from quite a low point. So I know you did hit on something there. Do not despair. We can't always feel inferior to our American cousins in
Well,
certain
no,
aspects.
I was actually your point there as to, make it almost impossible for people not to be emblazoned with messaging that tells them, as you were saying, specifically on the topic of immigration. I think if you could just make it so that people couldn't avoid constant framing of the entire political class not as incompetent, but as just outright evil.
Yes. Honestly, like people's desire to kid themselves about how benign our politicians are when they are absolutely profoundly malignant. That's the most frustrating thing. And if there's ways to just force the reality in front of their eyes, and it has to be again and again, many times a day, like before they will stop, deluding themselves, which they're so keen to do. If there's something that can do that, then that would be great. In terms of our movement, I don't know if that's what you're asking, but I've thought for ever since I first got involved in things a few years ago, I've just thought that we're not using the online space as much as we should. I'm surprised how what a lack of positivity there is about the possibilities of online activism. I mean, I know that it's hard. I know there's a lot of things that get in the way. Obviously, the social media love to chuck us off, but Twitter's a an opportunity now. But I mean, like the griping thing, I think was really good. If you had people dedicated to doing that, frequently,
Like
that
a
does make a
right-wing correct the
difference, doesn't
record
it?
almost. You're right. I think honestly, having like organized narrative crafting is not something that people will engage in. It's a bit depressing.
That's way too much hierarchy and subordination amongst people for the cats that we have to herd to even get
Yeah,
something like
it's.
a nomos event off the ground. It's organization, organization, organization. It's always the root kind of cause for all this stuff. You always have to come back to what resources have you got? How many people have you got? What kind of man hours can you actually commit to achieving goals of some variety?
And are they prepared to take orders more or less?
Yes.
That's another thing.
I think there should be
unpaid as well.
That's what I'm going.
Unpaid as well. That's the thing. You're going to take orders from someone and not get paid for it.
That's the thing. In that, there's also kind of the monetary aspect. I don't know how much you know about what we do with our real life events, but we run a.
Oh, I nearly came to the last one, and then I couldn't at the last one.
Oh, it's a shame.
Hopefully, we'll catch you at one of the next ones. Then
we're still trying to figure out what that'll be. Because we just kind of organize it ourselves. But no, there was my speech at the last one basically was about this, that there is a bit of a chicken and egg situation in terms of kind of the practical solutions. But, you know, first of all, people do need money. There do need to be monetary resources there. People need lawyers. We need to be not get sued out of existence.
Yes.
Then we need to be able to organize, and then really we can start doing things. I think that there's a lot of people who put barriers in their own way, but you are right. There is a lot of simple stuff that could be done even just online.
Sorry. You've not got the lower third tip.
I've got the thumbnail up, haven't I? Sorry, I've actually got the bit of the thing up here. But it's the point is that yes, we could just have a topic that people talk about on like a certain week or a certain day or whatever. You know, we could organize like informational bursts, as it were. Because that's, if you look at the, I know you mentioned Gamergate, like one of the things that they did, you know, during Gamergate in terms of the opposition was they had all these mailing lists they were on, and they did narrative craft. And, you know, that's seen in a journalistic sense. It is, you know, unethical to do that without disclosure. It's supposed to be. But it's what journalists on the left have been doing for many, many years. And griping was kind of unfortunately went nowhere in the end.
Yeah.
But it for a while kind of felt like people were at least feeling somewhat unsafe.
Well, I think the moment people from our side begin to realize that you aren't alone, there is a small amount of strength in numbers to some degree, and that if you are more savvy than the average shitlib, you know, if you know the person you're actually trying to influence via social media is first and foremost real.
Yeah.
Which in today's age isn't the easiest thing to do, but
no, there's a lot of, I think, online arguments that are going on with paid actors on in the opposite camp.
Well, Stephen, it's that. Think of just the number of opportunities where so much energy has been wasted on bad targets.
Yeah.
And not actually trying to attack things that are lasting, that the regime requires to have, you know, the public to have some level of respect and loyalty for to keep it going.
So
the regime doesn't require, you know, the next progressive fad to exist for the next 40 years. All it needs is for the last 10, 15 minutes to they distract us today. And then they'll distract us with something else tomorrow. So sitting attacking the current thing always is the problem.
So Horace, in an ideal world then, what would online right-wing activism look like to you?
Well, you probably, let's say you have like private groups where you decide on a target or, you know, an aim for a session. Basically need to like all be online. Oh, God. I'm thinking on the spot here.
It's kind of an awkward question, I know. But
it needs to be organised in the background, that's for sure. You know, like, but I mean, you can't try and trick people. They need to, you know, you have to be real. I think one of you were alluding to this a moment ago. You need to sort of respect the people you're talking to rather than just see them as marks or just as normies to be converted or NPCs or whatever. You've got to treat them with a degree of human respect, you know, otherwise they will just see you coming. They will just see you as someone aggressive and not very nice, you know. like coordinated days of action, involving loads and loads of people all at once, all trying to achieve the same thing, but I'm aware that I'm still being vague there.
Oh no, it's fine. It's something that I think that people don't like. the very fact that it isn't talked about and thought about that much, I think, is a bit of a problem. One of the better things I remember is actually AA doing things like Evola Day and Carlisle Day, and a lot of people kind of being brought along with that, not even in just like a coerced sense, but a lot of people just, they like the energy of that and having a thinker to talk about for a day. And
it's the sort of universal formula for all social phenomena. As someone's got to, like, it's the way they always used to sit in school. Someone's got to drive the bus. You know, there has to be someone that gets the ball rolling with a lot of things. One of the things I wanted to make the big point of when we were on Millennial was that for us, where we are at the moment, we can't be activists in the way that left are. We can't be loud. We aren't expendable, at least not in the same way at the moment. We don't have money behind us. We can't be entirely, you know, safe in the knowledge of the fact that some big legal system's going to defend us and there's fancy lawyers just waiting in the wings for us who are ideologically inclined. We can't do that. But instead, what we can be is something that neither the leftist activists nor the political class nowadays are, which is respectable. If you're just a respectable sort of, what would the phrase, vehicle for your ideas and your values, that's so much more effective than just being a screaming lunatic in the eyes of otherwise normal people.
Yeah, it's a big thing, like you talked about, is being able to approach people and talk to them on their own terms, which is something that a lot of online activists from other camps can't really do. A lot of it is message, it is like cold message crafting rather than human. And I have quite enjoyed meeting a lot of people in these spheres, and just the general sense of humanity there is here, I think, is very heartening. That is a big thing, I think. But it is a big topic.
That did trigger me to think of one thing, that one clear thing I can say about online activism is that it should be targeted and intentional and purposeful rather than just shitposting, which I've always just found completely pointless. I can't believe the amount of time wasted on that. Like just going in and telling people who are never going to agree with us that they're pricks or whatever. It's like, well, what is this doing? Like, what I found is that I would sometimes spend time, you know, when I was on Twitter, say, I would think of what is actually going to get through to people, or what is actually going to change people's view, you know, not just tell them that they're an idiot or anything. And one thing I found was I just thought, what is it that people, what myths do people have about it? Because I just think it's crucial to defeat the Tory party for exactly the same reason that I think our enemies see the value of the Tory party, and the same in, you know, the centre right in each country. This has been something that I think Keith Woods and Joel Davis have picked up on recently, have been talking about recently. There's this professor called Stephen Ziblatt, and he wrote one book collaborating with another guy, it's about democracy, but he's also written this essay saying that we see again and again through the last century or so, maybe further back, that, and he's writing from, you know, he's an enemy of ours. He's saying, like, centre-right parties are of particular importance to the survival of what he calls democracies. But he means essentially, like, I would say, you know, places controlled by the tribe, really. He was talking about, you know, Weimar Germany and stuff, and he's talking about America now, and he's talking about Britain now. Bringing down these centre-right parties, I think, is the big target. I think nothing can be achieved. There is no, we're not in any real sense fighting the left until we defeat the fake right. Now, what I found in the case of the Tories, especially when Boris Johnson was Prime Minister, was that a lot of people seriously believed, I mean, they're idiots for believing in it, but they seriously believed that he was against illegal immigration, that he was against the boats coming over. This is completely wrong. Like, Boris Johnson is as pro-immigration as any politician there's ever been. But I just put together this thread of all the times when he's not only, you know, said what they call liberal things about immigration, but he's positively called for illegal immigrants to all be given British citizenship.
Yeah, I tried to do the same thing. In fact, God, I used to be a bit closer to Sargon in his circles, and I did the same thing where it's just like, look, Boris Johnson is not our guy. He is the pro-amnesty former mayor of London.
Everything that's wrong with the Tory party is in that man. He's the worst.
He is. I appreciate being animated. He's terrible, but it's a trap that people fall into constantly. And I think, honestly, some of the Elon stuff has been part of that.
Yeah.
Because I don't, like, he's a subsidy sponge who wants to put chips in people's brains. And
it's like a libertarian, then.
Yeah, I'd like people to just, you know, I've always tried to remind people who we're dealing with in many areas. Boris Johnson was one of them, you know, and I think there's a lot of this.
So there's still quite a lot of people on Twitter who are backing Boris and they want Boris back. So this is actually still worthwhile. Just making each one of those people painstaking, you know, one at a time, doing manual effort for each person. But I think it's worth it. Just making them aware of this history he's got. He's the most pro-immigration person there is. And I found that doing that, I created this thread, you know, I refined it over time. I posted it a few different times, having edited it and stuff. I found that really did travel. That traveled beyond our circles. And this was when I was on Twitter with it being heavily biased against us, which I think the algorithm has been somewhat neutralized now in a good way. I found that was traveling way beyond just white nationalist circles or nationalist circles or whatever. It was good. It was doing something. So thinking along those lines, I think, makes your time online worthwhile.
Yeah, it's not to spoil something we may or may not have in the works as a future stream, but in a similar vein, we discussed the other day that if you look at Nigel Farage, not from moment to moment, but his role on a wider sort of timescale and the British right, he's really just existed to subvert all of the energy and waste what was there from the BNP.
Yeah, he's really there to get people together, get them to expend a bunch of energy and then just dissipate it. I think he's one of the most effective agents, effectively, like the Tory party machine almost, and that he always reintegrates them. And I think there needs to be, you know, more than just kind of ripping people away from the Tory party, which is worthwhile in of itself. There needs to be something built, even not just electorally, because I don't think we can compete electorally, really, as the story of the BNP really shows. It's a bit of a futile route, but just in terms of organization, in terms of like it's a parallelism, there needs to be something built that people can turn to or look to or get more information from that isn't undermined once they reach that point. Because it's kind of amazing that UKIP got to 10% national polling, 15% by some metrics, and yet never had a single MP in Westminster, and then just completely collapsed, and all the energy that was
first past the post for you.
Yeah, and then all the energy that was invested in that completely dissipated. It was put into Boris, and it was dissipated again. It's kind of genius how this is done, but there needs to be something kind of outside and beyond party politics that people can belong to, and that really doesn't exist. And I think that's one of the biggest failings in British politics.
Yeah, I mean, that's something I'm quite useless at, because I really do think in terms of party politics and elections and stuff, and I don't believe it's all futile. Not that you guys were saying it was, but a lot of people do. A lot of people say there's no electoral road. It's like, well, as far as I'm concerned, we've got to attack on various fronts, including electorally.
You can gum up the kind of electoral machinery. I think that's but I think there needs to be quite deliberately, like, anti, you know, I don't say anti-politics, but kind of in that sense, it needs to be like almost like sabotage level rather than, you know, trying to actually the majority in parliament level. That I think the idea, like a lot of people, it needs to be a balance. Like you said, you can't completely give up on a lot of avenues because you do need to compete, at least have a presence in the kind of the party political machine side of things to do messaging and to, you know, to at least cause chaos. But it's something that needs a considered approach.
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with what you say about having a sort of a saboteur approach. It would be great, even if there was a party that had no resources, just enough money to put down deposits in each constituency, and just put up a candidate. Just to have that, I think, would be good, even if we don't expect it to do that well. Because just many, many conversations that I have come round to people who are basically, they're Tories who are furious at the Tory party, but like their question is, what's the alternative? If there is The thing is, I mean, a lot of them are not even asking honestly, because you name an alternative and they go, oh, yeah, but first past the post, so they haven't got a chance, so I'm not going to vote for him. So, well, fuck it. Like, so what were you asking? You know? Like, every alternative happens to be unviable in their mind. I mean, people like that, you can't do anything with. They're just, you know, like, they're just servants of the machine. They're just morons. Like, but there are, but there's people in between us and them who are looking for, who really are looking for an alternative. And, you know, they're the sort of people who are now convincing themselves that Richard Tice is going to get somewhere.
No, I think
Richard Tice is no friend of ours. Like, he's no good. But these people are at least prepared to stop voting for, you know, they're not letting the first past the post thing stop them voting for smaller parties. So I think they deserve credit for that.
I think that there needs to be some kind of mechanism, an organization to give these people something to do outside of the merely electoral. I mean, the answer to a lot of those people is that, I'm sorry, you're going to have to stop voting and start, you know, trying to help your communities yourself.
Mm.
And that's what a lot of people don't want to hear, that because it's not an easy route and it's a slow route.
Well, yeah, like, I think there's a very good reason to be skeptical of that. I mean, I do agree with you, but like, if you say that to me, that sounds like the work of 30, 40, 50 years. But we're going to already be a minority within, say, 20 or 25 years. It's like, it sounds like giving up. I know it's not, but it sounds like giving up. It sounds like just admitting defeat.
I think we may as well begin to think ourselves a minority already. I think it would be to just accept that reality as it is.
Well, there are the immediate things that can be done, and there are some things that could have a turnaround. But ultimately, what I'm saying is, yes, to actually build something that has permanence will take, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. But it's both. It's the, you know, the hare and the tortoise approach. I think a lot of people don't want to put that slow work in, especially people who are looking for a quick electoral fix. And it's not giving up, really. It's kind of, you know, there's a big pile of shit here. Yeah, if you get a shovel and you get enough people, you can move it. And that's the mentality I try and have. And that actually the worse things get, the more you can do. Because it's, you know, it's like throw a dart, basically.
Yeah.
As things get worse, there's actually more that can be done on a community level and on an interpersonal level. I think giving those people, even just online, a space to communicate, organize, vent, and find like-minded people is a big one. The biggest thing that I found with kind of like nascent dissidents is that they feel completely isolated. They do not know anyone in real life they can talk to. And as much as, you know, we do like the internet, and we are on the internet, it's a great organizational tool. It has so much more impact if you can actually talk to these people face to face, I've found. But that's, I don't know, that can be a way off. A lot of those people need some confidence building before they'd even imagine going outside and talking about the ideas they have, even with other people that they think might be like-minded. So it's there's a lot more of like, well, it's not some, you know, there's not an immediate fix of someone you can vote for right now, but, you know, here's some people you can talk to, here's a space you can be, here's some resources. What we really need is like a dissident right starter pack. We need to essentially find some sort of equivalent of like a goodie bag we can give these, you know, the just about hanging on Tories that will give them resources and make them not feel alone and give them places to talk. And it's kind of there. There are, you know, we have there's Telegrams, there's Discord, there's places like that. But there isn't really, like you said, it needs to be organized, and it needs to have like an outer party and inner party thing about it. It needs to have a group of people dedicated in private who have a shared goal, who are willing to make these things. I mean, it sounds silly, but I honestly think it would be extremely useful to have like a resource we can give those people that you know, communicates effectively to them, that they can effectively sit like a dissident 101 course. It's in some way, but
I agree. I think if you were to do that, I think another sort of potential objection you need to meet, though, this is what would occur to me if you propose that to me, and I've never heard of this movement or anything. It would be, surely if the government is already sort of at war with you, surely if dissidents like you try to form a parallel economy, try to form a separate community, try to take over a certain area or anything like that, or try to found a community in the woods or to get away or to just be alternative in any way, the state does have the power, maybe not the legality, but it does have the power to just destroy these things, doesn't it? I mean, in most cases, it can just bring in loads of thugs to come in and just smash up whatever you physically build. That's one thing, you know.
It's the whole thing is that that is actually a great leap in resources, and you know they might come and get you, but also you know you have made them come and get you. They've expended a large amount of energy. And, you know, not to get...
an individual, you can see why they would say, yeah, but if it's me who takes on all that cost and then just loses what I've built, I'm not really going to care about what it's cost the state. I'm just going to care about having wasted my life for 10 or 20 years.
But the issue is that, unfortunately, we've reached a point where we need to have, you know, there are smarter ways of doing it. There are ways that you don't draw as much attention to yourself and you lower the risk of that happening. Not being silly, but... there's also the other aspect of it, which is we've also just reached the point where we need people who care enough that they're willing to risk that.
Yeah, you cannot start a dissident political movement by bringing in a bunch of people who are self-interested for material concerns and then expect that to be an effective political force.
I saw Radical Liberation Radlib in chat, and I'm a big fan of. He made a point during his speech at the WITAN about the fact that maybe not in terms of, you know, the literal sense, but that also creates like financial, you know, and social and maybe custodial in terms of people go to prison. It creates martyrs, essentially. It shows people, look, this happens. The government is going to get people. They are going to come for you. And it's a very useful tool in, you know, bringing people in and waking people up. He centered his talk around kind of how the persecution of the early church backfired. But if you are able to create an organization that's resilient enough to survive being persecuted, the fact that you are visibly being persecuted does affect other people and affect people around you. And it does bring a lot of attention and a lot of sympathy a lot of the time to what you're doing. So you're right, it's kind of a mix of both, in that you can minimize the risk of that if you don't want to be as involved. But there's also the case that, unfortunately, things are bad enough that there are going to be people who need to be willing to sacrifice.
We need martyrs.
Yes,
this
essentially.
Is basically the point.
I agree. That's very true. And, of course, the more people prepared to take on, you know, the pain of dissidents, like, you know, who've really thought about how bad it could get and are prepared to do it anyway, the better, obviously. That is empowering. That sort of constructive desperation, you could say. The willingness to put yourself in danger, perhaps mortal danger. I mean, that can inspire other people, and it really affects how you act, right? I'd say one slight little reason for optimism is, you know, after the sort of the first couple of months of the lockdowns in 2020, this so-called freedom movement started forming. And I noticed in the Hope Not Hate report, obviously we know that Hope Not Hate is not really about racism. It's about destroying all opposition to the ruling class, really. They, in one of their reports, I believe it was 2021, I think it was, they did a report, and it was like, you could tell, I don't know if they were trying to hide it or what, but you could tell they were alarmed by the fact that you had people like Piers Corbyn, who, you know, is ostensibly a hard leftist, a communist, at same events as people like, I can't remember which right-winger example they cited, I can't remember, maybe it was David Curtin or something, I'm not sure. But they said, like, there's a very disturbing possibility of a left-right alliance forming. And the more people just blend as much as possible and just mutually support, obviously, and cooperate with other dissidents, regardless, you really have to put aside the importance of the disagreements, regardless of whether you agree with every tenet of their beliefs, the more people are prepared to do that and actually do it, that is a is a real problem for the you know, I don't know what you call them, the centre, the establishment, the ruling class. It really made me laugh, put a big smile on my face when I read Hope Not Hate saying it was something like a disturbing left-right alliance. I was like, yes, right, more of that. Press in on that as hard as possible, because that frightens them.
Is this the note we'll finish on then?
Yeah. I'm just getting up the Greggs image. Are you aware of the memes of Turning Point Greggs and things like that? The North FC memes are quite prevalent.
I've seen them. I never knew what they were getting at. I've seen the North Greggs thing. I didn't get why the Turning Point thing was
turning kids into
Oh no,
posters.
It's a joke about Turning Point USA, because Turning Point USA had all these terrible marketing campaigns that were cringy. Yeah. And slightly neo-con. Yeah. So it's a joke about like Turning Point Greggs, about like, you know, very north of England, not very ideological people. And one of my favorite ones is just the North Baz shaking hands with Abdul and says Baz and Abdul united against turning kids into pufters, which I thought was just really funny.
That's a bit like the Birmingham thing in 2019.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually partially what it's referencing. But that's
that's the one time in my life I've really been rooting for the Muslims, and I really sincerely was as well.
There's
absolutely right behind you, defending your children, like, good for you.
There is, I know there's, you know, there wouldn't be kind of bringing them into the movement thing, but I guess we can finish slightly on this. There is like nascent reactionary tendencies in certain communities that it might not bring them on side, but it certainly might sever some of their links with the establishment. I think that's one of the most underexploited aspects of all of this in Britain. And a lot of people get very angry when you suggest kind of fomenting that in those circles. They're like, no, you just want to fill our movement with Muslims. It's just like, no, I'd like to sever some of the establishment teats that they
we
have.
We want to use them as our golem.
Yeah.
they wouldn't join our movement anyway.
No,
of course they wouldn't.
It's completely repulsive to them. But like, yeah, like, I mean... Yeah, I would absolutely, without any qualms, happily sit down and work with them for weeks if it was a way to, you know, stop the trans agenda being pushed to children and stuff. Absolutely. Like, they're good. Some of them are really good people. I mean, there's nothing to think about. Of course we can work with them on that. Like, of course we can.
You're right. It's something that people need to be, I think, less squeamish in certain aspects.
There's no problem there whatsoever. Yeah. Like, we've got the enemy. The enemy is the people who brought them in. Like, the enemy is not them.
We're going to finish in a couple minutes. Is there anything you want to shill or quickly talk about before we do?
Anyone who's not following my Odyssey channel, if you want to see the new stuff that I'm going to put out soon, just follow it and you'll see it.
Yeah, that's all of your social media, your Twitter, your. Odyssey and your Telegram are all linked in the description. I've put your Odyssey in the chat as well. So if you want to follow Horus, all the links are down below. We've done our due diligence there. It was great having a conversation with you. I think we need to. We do try and have these as much as possible. But
it's just good to get to know folk in the sort of UK right sphere as we, spread our tentacles out.
The less there is to separate us into several little dissident fragments in an already small movement, like, the better, you know?
Yes.
And you guys putting on events, obviously, I mean, perhaps it goes without saying, but I mean, that's helping bring people together. It's helping people get used to meeting in real life, which, you know, like, some people won't experience. And it's also proving that things that some people think are impossible are not possible. I mean, you know, like, a lot of people think, oh, everything has to, you know, hide from the enemy, but you're proving that we can meet up in person. It should be such a basic thing, but it's not. It does take organisation, doesn't it? So,
yeah, on that more positive note, I think we'll end then. So I'll say goodbye from me.
And a goodbye from me.
See everyone.
Ah, there we go. We are.